I awoke with a start. The sound of a kettle drum rolling made me jump out of bed and hurry to the open window. Who the devil could be beating a kettle drum at such an unearthly hour? It had only just gone 7 o'clock, and the sun was barely above my tall pine trees. I looked out of my bedroom window into the orchard below, searching the gaps between the olive trees. Not a soul to be seen. I wondered, as I stood there, if some boys from the village weren't playing a joke on me. After all, I was still a comparative stranger. To the locals, I was that chap from Paris who's bought the mill. I doubted if they knew that I had settled here in the heart of Provence, because it was here in the land of olives and oleanders that I was born. Anyway, no one was going to drive me out, and certainly not some village lad with a drum. I stood for a minute or two, gazing out at the view. The morning sun sent its rays through the pale mist that hovered in the valley. A lone curlew hopped onto the top rail of the orchard fence and shook its wings, and the tips of the distant pines began to sway in the morning breeze. All this, I thought, was mine, my true and beloved home. I waited another minute, and then, not hearing any more drum beats, I thought that the boys had had enough fun and were on their way back to the village. But I was wrong. As I turned from the window, I heard another roll on the drum, this time louder than before, and coming in short staccato bursts, as though beating out a signal. I looked again into the orchard, and there, moving in the gaps between the olive trees, I saw a man. Not a boy, as I had thought, but a man. Middle-aged, grey-haired, and a little on the stout side. He appeared to be wearing some kind of fancy dress, though precisely what I couldn't make out. Suddenly he stopped and stood in the open, halfway between two trees. And it was then that I realized that he was wearing the uniform of an officer in the old Royal Regiment. Some of the tunic buttons were undone, and the trousers were too short and too tight, but it was the regiment's uniform, all right. He began to march forward, beating another roll on the drum, which was hanging from his waist belt. To and fro he marched, quite oblivious of the birds that flew up almost from beneath his feet. I dressed quickly and went down into the orchard, feeling rather annoyed that this stranger should have the audacity to come into my orchard and disturb my sleep. As I approached, he stopped and turned quickly, taking a step towards me, almost as though he were expecting someone. There was a smile on his face, and an odd, remote look in his eyes. "You are trespassing, monsieur," I said. "This is private property." It was a moment or two before his eyes seemed to focus on me, and then, realizing that I had spoken to him, he swept off his hat, that was much too small for him, and said, "Oh, forgive me, monsieur. I meant no harm. I thought for a moment that you were—" And suddenly he broke off. And then, as he turned to go, he added, "I'm so sorry, monsieur. I really didn't mean to disturb you." I can't say why, but I felt a sudden surge of pity for this strange, lost creature. And, not quite sure how best to deal with him, I said, "Did you think I was someone else, then?" The stranger looked me full in the face, and with the beginnings of a smile said, "Yes, monsieur, strange as it may sound, I did." Something inside me prompted me to say, "You know, you're quite welcome to stay for a bit, if it will help you." "No," he said slowly. "It's most kind of you, but—" And he broke off. There was such a note of disappointment in his voice that I walked up to him and touched his arm. "You don't have to go," I said. "I'm sorry if I sounded annoyed just now. You see, I thought the children from the village were playing practical jokes, getting me out of bed before sunrise." The man's face never lost its look of sadness, of detachment. "I told you I was sorry, monsieur," was all he said. "But there's no need to apologize," I told him. "You're quite welcome to stay. Look, come up to the house. You look as if you could do with a cup of coffee." He looked at me with that same sad expression. "You are very kind, monsieur," he said. "But I'm too late. 30 years too late." His answer sounded so odd that I began to wonder if the man had escaped from some institution, or whether he was on the point of some kind of nervous breakdown. "Look, do come," I said. "To tell you the truth, I'd be glad of your company." I may say I was still wondering how I could send for help if the man really was ill. As we walked towards the house, he looked up at me and said, "I suppose you must think I'm mad behaving like this. But I have a reason, monsieur. Oh, yes, I have a reason." As we sat in my mill by the open window with a pot of coffee between us, I decided to take the bull by the horns. "Down there in the orchard," I said, "you told me you were too late." "Too late for what?" He sipped his coffee reflectively. "It was all a very long time ago, monsieur." I was determined not to give up. "Tell me about it. It might help if you talked to someone." I hated myself at that moment. We authors are nothing but hyenas on two legs, always scavenging, looking for a story. "Perhaps you are right, monsieur," my newfound visitor said. "It can't do any harm to talk to you. And who knows, it may even help me to find her." I forced myself to stay silent and waited for him to go on. He put down his coffee. "Oh, I'll find her some day," he said quietly, intensely. "I know I shall." I waited. "When I joined the regiment," he said, "I thought the colonel was an old man. He was only 42, but to me, a subaltern of 20, he seemed like someone from another age. Well, the colonel had a young, beautiful wife, Emily. She was the same age as myself. We met at one of the regimental parties, and before long I found I was in love with her. It was agony not to be near her in those first months. And then, suddenly, she sent me a note. It was an invitation to her birthday party." The man sipped his coffee. Now he was no longer detached and remote. "I shan't bore you with the details of the party," he said, "but that night I discovered that Emily, the colonel's wife, felt about me as I did about her. She told me she hated her husband. He was stiff, cold-hearted, and thought of nothing but himself and his career. Well, Emily and I became lovers. We had a secret rendezvous in your orchard." "My orchard?" I exclaimed. "Oh, of course it wasn't an orchard in those days," he said. "Just a piece of barren land covered in gorse. There were rabbits, too." "The rabbits are still there," I told him. "But the gorse has been pulled up, and your old barracks demolished 20 years ago." My visitor went on. "We used to have a signal, Emily and I. I bribed the regimental drummer to beat a certain roll on his kettle drum near the colonel's quarters. If anyone asked him what he was up to, he used to say that he was practicing for Sunday's parade." By now, fascinated by the man's tale, I asked, "But what did the signal mean?" He smiled. "If Emily heard the drum, she knew it was a signal for her to meet me that night at our rendezvous." He pointed to the orchard. "Down there," he said, and smiled. "Well, everything was fine for about 3 months. Until one day in late summer, just as she and I were coming out of the orchard after one of our clandestine meetings, I saw a man crouching by the undergrowth. It was the colonel's batman, a sly, untrustworthy fellow called Grappazzi. Emily saw him too and tried to hide her face, hoping not to be recognized. She pleaded with me to get rid of the man. 'Give him money,' she said. 'Anything but get rid of him.' Well, I gave him money, but of course it was a mistake. He came back for more, and more, and then more again. I was at my wit's end. And then, on top of everything else, I had a letter from Emily. She told me that Grapazzi, the batman, had been blackmailing her, too. But the price was different. He had forced her to let him make love to her when the colonel was away on maneuvers. She told me she had sacrificed herself to save my name from exposure. My visitor pointed to the coffee jug. May I? Of course, I said. Help yourself. He did so, and then went on. I needn't have worried about the scandal. It all came out at the inquest. Inquest? I said. What inquest? A man was killed, my visitor said enigmatically. Emily ran away. She told me in a letter that she felt such terrible shame that she couldn't bear to stay a day longer. She also left a letter for the colonel telling him that she was in love with one of his officers, but she didn't reveal his name. She also told the colonel about the batman and what he had done to her. The colonel read the letter, sent for Grapazzi, and then simply shot him through the head before he could even open his mouth. Of course, it was all hushed up. The official report said it was an accident. But then later, people began to talk. Finally, the gossip was so bad that I was forced to resign. My visitor was silent again, once more detached and distant. Today is Emily's birthday, he said simply. I always beat the drum on her birthday. He finished his coffee, and together we walked back to the orchard. Abruptly, he asked, Monsieur, please, may I come again next year? I'm sure she'll come, sooner or later, if she hears the drum. I felt again a surge of pity for the man, still half crazy for the love of a woman he'd known so many years ago. Of course, I said, come every year and make as much noise as you want. I went back to the mill and, turning, saw him walking away into the morning sunlight. Soon he had disappeared into the pine trees. But long after he had gone, I heard in my mind the plaintive roll of his drum.